Welcome to Variant Frequencies. Month to month, our podcast brings you fiction stories from a different channel. Sci-fi, fantasy, horror, and some odd bands in between. Visit us at www.variantfrequencies.com. Hello, I'm Rick Stringer. Our story today is by D.M. Murley. Previously, we ran the story Old Tricks that she co-wrote with Matt Wallace. Our narrator is one of our favorite voices. He is Jan Dalton. Fans of the Failed Cities monologues know Jan as the Maven. Now, on to our story. Gil Bando by D.M. Murley. Not one of the assorted politically motivated killers in this bar knows they're about to die. But that's the thing about suicide bombers. You never see them coming.
I have to admit, I'm a little flattered when I realize that in just a few moments, Gillian fucking Bando is going to turn suicide bomber and take me and everyone else in this opposition bar with her. It's like having Da Vinci say he wants to paint your portrait in C4, and I know it's the most I could have ever asked from this life, to be vaporized alongside the master of the big boom, the queen of all detonator junkies. And yes, it's probably more than I deserve. I'm the schmuck who catches the pissed-off teen's bullet, the genius who hops into the car with the drunk celebrity before the fatal accident. But in a way, I had to be here. Our fates keep converging, like they're drawn together by some other force. And they've been that way for long before now. Long before she came into the room wearing an unseasonably thick coat, going nearly unnoticed in a crowd that usually notices strangers, long before she started heading for the empty seat next to me at the bar. It's hard to gain notoriety as a suicide bomber unless you're particularly inept at it, so this is a real expansion in her skills. She made her name as your average cold-hearted, politically and occasionally personally motivated bomber, and stepped into her own legend when she pioneered a particularly neat trick we like to call Family Night. It works like this. Gil sets to work rigging her bombs while her target and his family are out, and when she's done, she puts a brick through the window. When the family returns and spots the vandalism, Gil watches the target tell his loved ones, the wife, kids, to wait outside. She watches the soon-to-be-dead asshole go through his house, sees his relief when he discovers the brick, teenagers out having fun or somebody trying to put the fear in him, which inspires a bit of mad foolishness in the target, like, I'm not going to be scared out of my own house by nobody. And when he gives the all clear, and the kids and wife and dog or whatever else come rushing in the front door, that's when she presses the button. As you might say, that is some cold shit. As I might say, if Gil asked me right now, that's entertainment. Bombers are usually psychopaths, sociopaths, freaks, functioning freaks, unlike your average trembling, stuttering, bedwetting, mere arsonist. But despite their outcast nature, the essential component of being a bomber is the ability to be a ghost. If arsonists are the hairy-palmed mouth breathers leering at the prom queen, bombers are the unseen outcasts plotting a massacre. You know the one. He seemed so quiet, a loner. There was no sign. Any malcontent with a chemistry set and a lot of free time can make a bomb. placing it so it goes undetected, getting away as quickly as possible without drawing any attention, that's where you've got to have skills. Double that for the suicide bombers. You know that soon you're going to be snuffed out so completely that they'll be lucky if they can locate one of your big toes. But you can't afford to be nervous, concerned, or apprehensive, lest someone notice and realize what you're up to. Take Gil right now. She's so calm and casual that the bartender hardly remembers pouring her drink. And me, though I seem to be dozing off contemplating my beer, I'm thinking about my leg. Judging the distance to the door, I'd never make it out of the room without her noticing me, the cripple limping madly for escape. Being crippled helps me set bombs, helps me get away without being noticed. Who'd suspect the harmless old guy with the shit leg? But it's a liability against Gillian fucking Bando, who's keeping one hand inside her pocket even as she enjoys a glass of 10-year-old single malt. Escape only crosses my mind for a fleeting instant anyway. I want to see what's going to happen. I want to be part of it. Maybe I didn't know I was going to die when I got up today, but I sure as hell know it now. And even if I'm not happy about it, I'm getting comfortable with the idea. With politics this dirty in the district and me being an active participant, I had to expect this to be my end. I like to think Gil's here to kill me, but it's way more likely that she's after the room in general, wanting to send a message to everybody on our side that not even the so-called safe zones are really safe. Gil doesn't look my way. Maybe she's already thinking about what it'll be like after the explosion. The carnage and chaos. The harried news reports and the traumatized survivors. That's what I always think about before the bomb goes off anyway. I've always been a forward thinker. In every country, they're the ones in charge and the ones who oppose the ones in charge. And every few years they switch sides, and bitterness comes with it. When the opposition is in power, all they can think about is how poorly they were treated when they weren't in power. So they treat the new opposition worse. Then, when the roles switch again, the new government gets their revenge. And at times these struggles need a little finessing, and the cons and the arsonists and the snipers and the bombers like Gil and me decide to supersede elections and politics and all that talk. I've always wondered if Gil's a believer or if she's just a killer. I had to figure that one out myself a long time ago, in the good old days when fanatics blew themselves up because they wanted to make a point of their own, before it was common to put a few bombers on the payroll to help you gain your political victory, back when the line between killers and idealists was clear. I don't want to cast aspersions on your character, but if you did what I did, you'd understand that the best way to feel alive is to kill someone else. Killing brings me a satisfaction that nothing else can. Even if once I was motivated by sparkling belief, the feeling that what I was doing was in service of good, I quickly lost that fervor and realized what my true nature was. Sure, the psychological motivation may have been power or justice, but the killing, that was what I lusted for. To see a severed leg lying in the street knowing that you had been the force that had brought it there, to be able to reward those who'd crossed you with death. No warm flesh, no amount of wealth, nothing in this world satisfies me anymore, except that long silence after the bomb has gone off and before the screaming starts. I'm not a believer. If I were, I might have told someone that Gil is in the room, or at least mentioned at some point that I knew what she looked like, since to most she's just a name somebody whispers to you when they're trying to make you jump out of your skin. The boogeyman for a certain often meddling political kind? You better watch out, or Gil Bando's gonna get you. But I don't care about the others who are going to die here with me. I didn't care about others who might have been saved if only they had known that the woman they saw outside their house before they went in had just planted a bomb inside. So I never told. Hard to say if anyone would have believed me anyway. The cripple with the shit leg. The cripple with the shit leg who got himself that way. The bomber who got bit. They tell you everyone gets bit eventually, and it's not rare to see people hanging around the party places casually hiding their new fingers with long sleeves. Even the most advanced regrowths never quite look right. People with fine lines where the grafts, grown in labs, replace their ruined skin. It's hard to hide what remains of my shattered leg, the total removal and replacement of which I would not allow. And though sympathy abounds, it's clear that even if everyone gets bit, no one wants to know about it. It's just not polite to be a walking reminder of what happens to the careless craftsman. Of course, they're assuming I got bit. They don't really know the whole story. But then, neither does Gil. She's been checking out my cane and making assumptions. It's one of the fancy smart ones. Automatically adjusts itself depending on how straight I can stand at any given time. Checks my vitals every few moments. It can even call for help if I fall. Gil's probably thinking, this stupid fucker got himself bit. The sight of my face does nothing to her. She orders another scotch. I reach into my pocket and spot the slight stiffening in her neck. When I remove a wrapped cube, the muscles slowly release. I take my time undoing the soft, milky pain tab, finally placing it far back in my mouth between the last set of molars on the right, and bite into it as if it's something luscious I want to treasure. It is. It melts under my teeth, and a kind of numb pleasure begins to push inside me, killing the throb in my leg, the pain in my joints. I begin to feel slightly lightheaded, but it could be the heat in here. I rarely take off my jacket, and even if it's a little thick for this weather, I'm keeping it on. Halfway into Gil's third scotch, the person she's meeting arrives in a cloud of self-importance. Paula Tompkins, a negotiator. Most of us wet works people don't deal with the negotiators, and most feel a general aversion to Paula Tompkins, who was once one of us, known as the best shot for at least 20 years. She once took a candidate's head clean off his shoulders with a large caliber bullet, leaving his body to continue to wave and walk for a few moments before it collapsed. At some point, she had some kind of change of heart, and now she negotiates for peace with the most active of us, trying to con us into laying down our arms like her. You just can't trust a person who swears off the satisfaction of a well-placed bullet in favor of words. If no one noticed Gil before, they sure as hell notice her now, since Paula has skipped the glad handing of the rebel forces negotiators usually engage in as they make their progress through any party room, and has taken the seat on the other side of Gil. A subtle flick of Paula's fingers activates a scrambler and a pre-recorded conversation track. To everyone straining to listen in, it sounds like they're talking about the latest scandal. Presidents, babysitters, foreign governments, illegal deals. It's all the same. To me, the only one who came equipped with a cracker, it sounds like they're talking about a ceasefire. It startles me that Paula Tompkins could be powerful enough to get a sit-down with Gillian fucking Bando on opposition territory in a crowd like this in order to discuss a ceasefire, and I'm sure the crowd wouldn't care for it either. But then, I guess that's why Paula's little-noticed, little-appreciated assistant gave me the heads-up about this meeting and not anyone else. There was really no need to let the whole room know what was about to go down, even if they would have believed it. I thought he was exaggerating or even fucking with me, but he just said that maybe I should go see what I could do about this situation, and I figured, why not? Most I was out was the cost of a drink. Unlike the computer actress playing her on the pre-recorded track, Gill sounds like a real person. Her voice is low-pitched, with occasional bits of hoarseness where she seems to struggle against a cough, the consequence of a long life mixing chemicals without a mask. Her answers are short and direct. Mostly she listens as Paula lays out the terms. Paula Tompkins and her earnestness are breaking that spot somewhere below my heart. She really believes Gillian fucking Bando would switch sides now, here, with her. I can't believe it. Won't. It's just not her style. I guess I think of myself as an expert, like Gill is my scholarly pursuit. Hard to say how I feel about Gill. She's good looking, but that's not too important. I've planted explosives in the cars and homes of some equally beautiful women and only felt a slight pang of regret that they would never live to switch to my side. So I'm not moved either way by her pretty face. Professional courtesy, too, can only go so far before it gets replaced with necessity. So as interested as I am, as invested as I am in her life and career, my mind still knows that she is the enemy, and she deserves death. Similarly, even if Gill had known that a guest was staying in the home of one of her intended targets the night she was going after him, she probably would have thought that the innocent should have chosen his friends more carefully. But it's not strictly about revenge either. Otherwise, I would have walked across the barriers of politics and class that keep me and Gill separated and brought down the entire building she lives in. Every bleeding man, woman, and child just a bonus on top of me, taking back my life from Gillian fucking Bando, the woman who stole it. Made me the one you whisper about behind your hands. The second rate. The washed up. My buddy had let me stay in his basement safe room, left over from when he and his wife had been younger and much more fanatical. They had been bombed before, but by civilians with flaming bottles of booze, not professionals. So they lived to take precautions and moved to a new neighborhood where safe rooms were standard. Now I was the radical, and I was waiting for some unwanted attention to die down after a beauty of a trick. A car bomb with a whole percussion section destroyed every window within a mile and sent quite a signal to the gentlemen who thought they controlled that particular mile. The safe room was more of a concession to my privacy and theirs than it was a real attempt at keeping me from harm. It was just some pissed-off cons after me, not actual killers. The only weapons most cons have are the words they share with the negotiators, but they use them for different reasons. No con wants peace. They use words to destroy people just like the rest of us use our toys. Most of the time I actually left the door open, as I did that night. They invited me out for crema and a walk, but I had told them to go ahead. I told them I was going to stay home and ponder my shitty life choices. They laughed and waved. My buddy's wife wiggled her long fingers goodbye to me. I had just begun to come out of a particularly alluring dream about blasting caps after the brick went through what must have been the living room window, and the absence of follow-up noises kept me from emerging fully from the dream. After that, it's bits and pieces. The buzz the alarm made when the front door was opened, my buddy's concern over the brick, the gentle click of the front door closing after they both came inside, believing it to be safe. Even with the door to the room open, I was spared much of the blast. The room had been equipped to survive bombings much worse. Actually, it had also been set to automatically close the door and call the authorities at the first sign of intrusion. But I'd cleverly disabled that system so I could sleep a full night without the door slamming closed and Fed showing up every time the cat wandered in the house. I came through with just some bruises, some burns. I should have stayed in there waiting to be rescued, but maybe some trace of altruism remained in me, or maybe I just wanted to see the remains of my friends blasted around their home, since it's so rare that you get to see something like that without being responsible. Either way, it was too late for them. I did make a token effort when I saw the wife's long fingers sticking out from under a pile of debris, reaching to dig her out. But the hand wasn't attached to anything anymore, and I realized I didn't need to go looking for anything else. I was almost out of the house when the supports gave, and I felt a pinch in my leg, but I didn't stop until I made it out the back door. My buddy's house was at the edge of a small, dingy park, one of those urban renewal things that had fallen on hard times. The grass had fled with civilization, but the trees, some kind of imported crap, had adapted well to the diet of poisoned groundwater and toxic fumes and become gigantic, twisted monsters that were easy to hide in. Standing near one of the trees was a woman, her hands in her pockets, her composed face fixed on what remained of the house. And I knew her instantly as the one who had caused this destruction. She regarded what was left with something like pride, the way a parent does when their child masters long division, the way I sometimes did when I was particularly pleased with my work. I wanted to look in her eyes. I wanted her to look into mine. I wanted the satisfaction of seeing what was in her and knowing that she could see the same in me, that connection, electric, when you meet someone so much like you. But before her attention could be drawn away from her creation to me, I noticed what had pinched my leg and dropped to the ground. Already enjoying shock, my mind cackled at the idea that I had gotten the world's biggest splinter. The shredded piece of support beam had gone in my thigh and come out the other side. There was barely any blood and no pain, and you could say that my giant splinter had saved my life, because if Gil had seen me when I was looking at her, she would have crossed the street and killed me with her bare hands. As it was, I found myself sinking into some thick bushes, and no doubt she took no notice of the piece of debris in the shrub. I know I was on my way out, but I have the feeling that maybe she did see me, maybe even thought about coming to get me. But the sirens were coming and she had to go. This was probably nothing more than a hallucination. She never saw my face, but I saw hers, and I knew I would see her again. It's things like that that tie people together. Paula Tompkins is getting on my nerves, asking Gil if she's read some of the pro-truce docs that have been floating around lately, wondering aloud why Gil would choose a ceasefire now, as if docs could change Gil's stripes. She doesn't explain. It's then that I know she is genuinely after peace. It's in the way she closes her eyes and finally says she's lost the taste for killing. She could be lying, feeding Paula Tompkins some lines, softening her up so that when Gil presses the button, Paula will be even more surprised. But she's not doing that. She's being completely honest. If I ever had a love, it was Gillian fucking Bando. If I ever had a god, it was Gillian fucking Bando. Every time someone brought up another one of her masterworks, her extraordinary creations, I was forced to keep myself from expressing my glee since we were on different sides. But I followed them quietly, patiently, knowing that I was the only living victim she had, that even if she didn't realize it, I was more important to her than anyone else. Listening to her renounce violence, to lay down the blasting cap and the wireless remote, robs me of my heart, my soul. And here, she undoes her jacket. And underneath is a shirt. And underneath there is nothing but skin and blood and bone. And I could shed tears for the loss of the only person who could have ever understood me. But we have a destiny, Gil and me. We have things we were meant to do together. When they pick us out of the rubble, they won't know what's her or what's me. You may judge me. History may judge me. God may judge me. And maybe I was a killer who hid behind a cause. And maybe no one loved me or trusted me. Maybe I knew it was going to end like this and I lied to you every second. But everyone's been lying to you in one way or another. And maybe you believe Gil, ready to shake hands, ready to lay down her arms, ready to amend for her sins, of which there are multitudes stretching out along the highways and barren parks and burned out shells of houses where families came home and discovered bricks through their windows and didn't realize they were in the last moments of their life. Maybe you feel sorry because my hand is on the detonator inside my pocket and the explosives on my chest feel warm and heavy. And no one will ever know that Paula Tompkins was on the verge of getting Gillian fucking Bando to agree to a ceasefire. And our way, my way, will continue as it always has until the next time someone tries to stop it and someone like me stops them. Peace is for people who are too afraid to remake the world one bomb at a time.
Thank you for listening to Gil Bando by D.M. Murley, narrated by Jan Dalton. We will have more about them on our MySpace and LiveJournal pages. To find out more about variant frequencies, please go to our website at www.variantfrequencies.com. If you like variant frequencies, tell your friends about us. Thank you from the Variant Frequencies team, Matt Wallace, Ann Stringer, and Rick Stringer.
Welcome to Lesson 110 of Learn Something New, 365 lessons that teach you something new every day. Today we will learn how to create a cyborg. Step 1. Engineer a near-death calamity. Popular death-defying scenarios include malfunctioning aerospace vehicles, car wrecks, and drunk karaoke showdowns. Step 2. Make sure to replace the following items: arms, legs, major internal organs. Please avoid replacing naughty bits with cybernetic replacements unless your cyborg is intending for a career in the adult entertainment industry or Capitol Hill. And finally, step 3. In replacing body parts, make certain the face is left intact in order to make that human connection. If your cyborg is in law enforcement, though, make sure your cyborg has a cool visor to wear across the eyes. To find out more about pimping out your mortal coil, subscribe to the cyberpunk novel Cybrosis at cybrosisnovel.com. This concludes Lesson 110, How to Create a Cyborg. See you tomorrow for Lesson 111, Flip Turns for Novice Swimmers.
Imagine a giant circus that runs around the clock and features ring after ring of attractions for fans of science fiction, art, science, and new media. Wouldn't you want to run away to that circus?
Now you can, because this very show, which goes by the name of Balticon, is coming to Marriott's Hunt Valley Inn, just north of Baltimore on Memorial Day weekend. From May 22nd to 25th, you can join over 1,000 other fans in a huge celebration. Charles Stross, one of science fiction's hottest writers, will be there, as will Kurt Miller, whose covers have graced many science fiction novels, and renowned singer Mary Crowell, and you can spend time with all of them. Love art? Go to the art show and view work by some of science fiction's masters, and if you fall for a piece, you can buy it! Interested in film or anime? Rooms with both are always available. Care to play a game? From tabletop games to live-action role-playing, gamers are ready for you to join in. Like to dress up? Join one of the best and largest costume contests on the East Coast. Want to laugh? Attend the special spoken word and comedy performance. Interested in new media? Balticon features the longest-running, best, and largest new media track available anywhere, with some of the most famous names in podcasting and webcomics. This year, attending as special guest of honor, is New York Times best-selling author Scott Sigler, the first author to release a novel in podcast-only form. Come meet him. For more information, drop by our website, www.balticon.org, or listen to our podcast at www.balticonpodcast.org. Join us May 22nd to the 25th. Balticon. You're never too old to run away and join the circus.